Once someone has been stripped of their humanity, almost anything can be done to them. That is the terrifying simplicity of dehumanization. The insult becomes the shove. The shove becomes the wound. The wound becomes the death. Each step feels like an escalation, but in truth, it is only the fulfillment of what language and systems have already prepared. Violence does not erupt in a vacuum. It grows in the soil of stories we've been telling ourselves all along. By the time the first blow is struck, the justification has already been rehearsed 1,000 times in words, policies, jokes, headlines. The act itself is only the final punctuation in a sentence we've been writing together. But violence is not only about the victim, it is also a mirror of the perpetrator. To harm another is to reveal what you have allowed yourself to believe. To cross that line is to declare, even silently, that your humanity matters more than theirs. And in making that declaration, you diminish your own. This is the paradox of violence. It aims to strip dignity from others, but it corrodes the dignity of the one who commits it. A soldier who tortures, a guard who beats, a neighbor who turns on a friend. They may feel powerful in the moment, but that power is hollow, bought at the price of their own moral reflection. Violence leaves a mark on both sides of the mirror. History remembers this, even when individuals try to forget. The names of victims are carved into memorials, yes, but the names of perpetrators are also preserved, in trials, in documents, in shame. Generations later, families still live with the weight of what their ancestors did or allowed. The mirror reflects forward, long after the moment of violence has passed. And yet, in the moment, violence often feels ordinary. The soldier pulls the trigger because it is expected. The mob throws the stone because everyone else is throwing. The police officer strikes because training and policy frame it as necessary. The ordinariness is what makes it possible. When cruelty feels normal, resistance feels strange. This ordinariness is why we must pay attention to the mirror, because violence does not only reflect intention, it reflects permission. It shows what a culture has allowed, what a society has encouraged, what individuals believe they can get away with. The mirror tells us less about the act itself than about the environment that made it possible. In Rwanda, neighbors killed neighbors with machetes. In Bosnia, people who had shared meals suddenly became enemies. In Nazi Germany, shopkeepers betrayed customers, colleagues denounced co-workers, children turned against teachers. These moments of betrayal did not come out of nowhere. They came from years of erosion, until violence seemed less like a choice and more like an inevitability. What makes violence possible is not only hatred, but imagination. An imagination corrupted by dehumanization. If someone is no longer fully human in your mind, then the violence you commit against them feels less like harm and more like justice, less like cruelty and more like necessity. That shift in imagination is the most dangerous weapon of all. And once violence is committed, it is rarely contained. It spills outward, gathering momentum. A single killing becomes a massacre. A single act of torture becomes a campaign. Violence has a way of legitimizing itself. The more it happens, the easier it becomes to continue. The mirror multiplies the image until the whole society is implicated. But here is the most haunting truth. Violence does not require monsters. It requires ordinary people. People who laugh, people who love, who believe themselves decent. People who would never imagine themselves capable of cruelty until the conditions align, until the system nudges, or until the language justifies. The mirror shows us not strangers, but ourselves. This is why denial is so common after violence. Perpetrators insist, "I was just following orders," or "I didn't have a choice," or "I was protecting my family." Each excuse is an attempt to shatter the mirror, to avoid facing the reflection. But no matter how often the excuses are repeated, the image remains. Psychologists call this moral disengagement. It's the mental gymnastics that allow us to commit harm while still seeing ourselves as good people. We tell ourselves the victim deserved it. We tell ourselves the harm wasn't real. We tell ourselves we were powerless. But disengagement does not erase the reality. It only hides it from our own conscience. The mirror, however, does not hide. It reveals. Even if we avert our eyes, the truth is there. What we choose to do to others shows who we are. Violence exposes the limits of our empathy, the boundaries of our moral imagination. It is not just an act against them. It is a portrait of us. So when we study violence, we are not only studying victims, we are studying perpetrators. We are studying cultures that permitted the cruelty, institutions that enabled it, bystanders who looked away. And if the reflection makes us uncomfortable, that is the point. Because to see violence clearly is to admit that the capacity for it is never far from any of us. When we ask how atrocities happen, we often search for monsters. We imagine figures so cruel, so abnormal, that their actions seem almost inhuman. But the harder question is not about the monsters, it is about the neighbors. How does an ordinary person, who once shared bread across the table, one day raise a weapon? The answer is uncomfortable, because they could, because the ground was prepared, and they stepped onto it. Violence rarely begins with conviction. It begins with hesitation, then permission, then momentum. The first strike is the hardest. The second comes easier. By the third, it feels like habit. And once habit takes over, cruelty no longer feels like a decision. It feels like routine. This routinization is what makes violence so enduring. People convince themselves they are no longer making choices. They are simply following the script. The system writes the lines, the culture supplies the stage, and the actors perform. By the end, no one feels responsible, even as bodies fill the ground. But the mirror does not forgive routine. Even if the act felt ordinary, the reflection remains extraordinary in its weight. Every violent action etches itself into memory, into culture, into history. And what felt like compliance in the moment becomes cruelty in retrospect. The excuse of just doing my job dissolves under the harsh light of memory. Denial becomes its own form of violence. To insist nothing happened, to silence survivors, to rewrite the story, these are acts of harm layered on top of harm. They protect the perpetrator's self-image at the expense of the victim's truth. And in that silencing, the wound deepens, passed from generation to generation. Communities fractured by violence do not simply heal with time. The mirror remains in the cracks of memory. Children inherit silences they do not understand. Whole families grow up carrying shame or grief that was never spoken. The violence echoes in the absence of words, in the absence of acknowledgement. And yet, acknowledgement is what the mirror demands, to look directly at what was done, to resist the temptation of euphemism, to name the cruelty for what it was. Without acknowledgement, the cycle waits for another chance, another repetition. History does not move forward, it circles. What we see in the mirror of violence is not only the act itself, but the capacity behind it. The capacity to to erase empathy, the capacity to rationalize harm, the capacity to turn silence into complicity. These capacities are not rare. They're human. And that is what makes the mirror unbearable to face. But unbearable or not, the mirror is always there. Every society that commits violence eventually confronts its reflection, sometimes through tribunals, sometimes through truth commissions, sometimes through art or literature. The confrontation is never easy, but it is necessary, because without reflection, there is no chance of repair. Repair does not erase the violence. It cannot bring back the dead or undo the harm. But it can prevent repetition. It can break the cycle of denial. It can teach the next generation that the reflection, while painful, must be faced. That courage means looking, not looking away. We must also admit something harder. The mirror is not only historical, it is present. It shows itself in prisons overcrowded with the poor, in border camps where children sleep on concrete floors, in neighborhoods where violence by the state is explained away as necessary force. These are not distant horrors. They are our reflections, here and now. And so the question becomes, what will we see when we dare to look? Will we see only the cruelty of others? Or will we see our own small permissions? The jokes we didn't challenge, the headlines we accepted, the silences we allowed. The mirror reflects both the grand and the ordinary, reminding us that violence always begins in places we would rather not notice. This is the hardest part of the mirror, realizing it shows us as well. The capacity for cruelty is not locked in history books. It is woven into the human condition. We may never commit it ourselves, but we live in systems that do. And unless we reckon with that fact, we risk repeating the same story under a new name. So violence is not only a mirror of the past, it is a mirror of the present, of the choices we make today, what we permit, what we ignore, what we excuse. All of it writes the script for what comes next. The reflection is not fixed. It shifts with us, depending on what we allow to stand and what we choose to resist. As this segment closes, hold on to this truth. Violence is never only about them. It is also about us. It reveals the depth of our empathy, the boundaries of our imagination, the honesty of our reflection. And if we do not dare to face what the mirror shows, we risk walking into the same future that so many before us have already rehearsed in blood.